And welcome everyone to another very special episode of Podcast Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, bud?
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing good, doing good. We're again just super lucky to have another amazing guest. We're honored tonight to be joined by screenwriter and filmmaker Daniel Waters. His legendary writing credits include Heathers, Batman Returns, Demolition Man, Hudson Hawk, The Adventures of Ford Fairlane, and Vampire Academy, which his brother directed. He also directed two features based on his own scripts, the underrated Happy Campers and the dark romantic comedy Sex and Death 101 with Simon Baker and Winona Ryder. He's got one of the most unique and idiosyncratic voices to ever work in the big-budget blockbuster arena, and clearly Heathers is an eternal classic that so many generations of audiences have latched onto as a key title. I just revisited it last night myself and can't wait to get into that. We can't wait to discuss his career in movies in general. Hopefully we can find out what those three seashells and Demolition Man really do, finally. So without further delay, welcome to the show, Daniel. It's an honor to have you here for a discussion.
Hi there. You know, I when I'm drunk and in the middle of the night, I'll look up Daniel Waters underrated and see what comes up. So glad you called Happy Campers underrated, because it's my key buzzword. I always think, because you know, I feel like a lot of things certainly have been rated very well. So I'll look up underrated at 2 a.m. just to see what happens.
Yeah, thank you so very much for coming on. Everything Nick said, I completely agree with. I have so many things I want to ask you, so I'm just right out of the gate.
The
first Batman is my favorite movie. It was the first film I saw in theaters. I was obsessed with it as a little kid. I remember I was 5 years old. My mom took me. I loved it. I had the trading cards, everything. Batman Returns came out. My mom took me opening day, and that movie scared the shit out of me, and I was like almost traumatized as a little kid, and I hated it for so long. And then when I got older and I watched it, I got it. And I'm now, as an adult, I'm as obsessed with Batman Returns as I am with the first film. Anyway, back to my question. I don't know if I've read this online somewhere. I had to have. Max Schreck, that character that Christopher Walken plays, at any point, was that originally supposed to be Harvey Dent?
You know, it never was.
Never?
Never.
Okay.
You know, Max Schreck was completely, you know, I needed Max Schreck. It's kind of like I was given the directive that I needed, obviously Batman, but I needed Catwoman and Penguin. And it was weird I was trying to, you know, create a plot, because I mean, Sam Hamm had written an original script, but we didn't use any of it. It was very old fashioned kind of action, very nice script, but it was definitely not what Tim was into. So I'm creating the script and I needed a character to kind of triangulate the other villains, like you think we had enough villains with Catwoman and Penguin, but I needed this character to kind of help me plot-wise. And, you know, in the original incarnation, my theme was that he was more like a Mitt Romney type or even a Trump type, but, you know, someone who is the normal society pillar of the community, who's the true villain. And, like, and then, of course, Christopher Walken takes over the role, and he's his, you know, chooses his costume, chooses his hair, and he's as loony as Catwoman and Penguin. So it's just kind of like three crazy people, when he was really supposed to be like, you know, my satirical comment on what true villainy is. But, you know, I try.
Interesting. Yeah, I sort of second to a certain degree what Frank said. The original Batman was, you know, I was 9 when it came out, and my father took me to a sneak preview, and I can still remember it like it was yesterday. And I remember.
Well, you know, it's funny. I saw it. I was already a grizzled adult when I saw I think it was Bat 89 it came out. And yeah, like honestly, I've met Sam. He's a great guy, but like, I honestly didn't like the first Batman, and I don't think Tim liked it either. And in fact, like, I was going to have Robert Wool's character for the first Batman. I wasn't going to have Harvey Dent in the movie, but I was going to have Robert Wool's. I pitched this to Tim. I was going to have him crucified onto the bat signal, and his kind of dead body gets flicked across Gotham City's sky. But Tim just said, no, I don't want to do anything. I don't want to bring up the first movie.
Well, that will sort of take me to where I'm going with my comment. At 90,
I just want to interject real quick. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'll be done with Harvey Dent after this next question. He'll be dead and buried. I just have always loved that character and comics and films, and he's always been my favorite Batman villain. I'm just curious. So, at no point you ever thought of having Harvey Dent's character in the film?
Well, you know, now that you're bringing it up, I do remember I just had one, I think in the very original draft I had, like, Billy Dee Williams is playing Harvey Dent in the first one, right? And I had one thing where he's just flipping a coin in the background of a scene, but we definitely chose, like, not to. Like, I had brought that up. Hey, you set up Harvey Dent. You want some Harvey Dent? You want an order of Harvey Dent on the side here? And Tim was just like, no, let's just do something completely new. So, I mean, like, I mean, I'm sure he showed up as Tommy Lee Jones, the third one, but definitely when I was on the Batman factory, you know, the Harvey Dent was not brought up.
And how did you get involved initially with Batman Returns, which for me is just one of the purest comic book movies that I can think of. Again, when I was 9 and saw the original Batman, it made a huge impact on me. It pretty much changed my life. And I can remember my father driving. We remember driving to see Batman Returns on opening day, and I was so pumped. And when I left that theater, my mind was again blown, but in a totally different way, because it was such a dark, not that the first one wasn't, but this was a really dark, menacing movie. And I really feel very strongly that Batman Returns is one of the purest comic book movies that has, like, ever been made. How did you get involved with the project? And
thank you for saying that. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, it has much more of a subconscious than the first one did. Whatever you think of the first one. I mean, the first one is, you know, certainly I can see having an impact when you're that young of an age. But, and it's great to hear you all say these things, but I have so many comic book fans who are my age and angry, bitter people who, you know, one of them, the best they'll say is, Batman Returns is a great Batman movie for people who hate Batman. Like, he's always given me the white glove test of everything I did wrong. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
No.
Well, it's funny. I actually got to when I think about taking the job for Batman Returns, I think of leaving a middle of a crazy set of Hudson Hawk in Budapest and escaping to go home to L.A. where I can start work on a Batman movie and not have to deal with the spiraling craziness that was Hudson Hawk. So it was an escape plan. But how did I get involved? Well, it did help that Denise DeNovi, who produced Heathers, who was her first credit as well as my first credit, she had become Tim Burton's producing partner. She had brought me in a while back about kind of just talking about a sequel to Beetlejuice. And, you know, I think I wasn't particularly vibing to that, but, like, I came in and I think I had, like, some take of he's with the first family in the White House and, you know. But Tim and I got to talking. I think we hit it off. So it was kind of like when I came back, they said, do you have any ideas for Batman? And I'm like, oh, boy, Batman. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of The Dark Knight Returns, the Frank Miller book. But I was not a comic book expert. But when I heard that they wanted to do something with Catwoman, that's where I came to life. Because Catwoman was, without, you know, being incredibly familiar with the character from the comic books, I just had a love of my idea for that character. And, you know, because I had always been reading, like, feminine psychology. And, like, I just think, you know, I'm not the greatest feminist. I'm not the most outstanding feminist in the world. I'm not going to come at you at that angle. But I do think when you make put a female character in a position of power, not like a boring, strong female character where she's a DA or something like that, but when you have a woman and you can really work with twisted psychology, it puts the audience off balance. And I think maybe a lot of what you guys were going through watching Batman and then watching Batman Returns is you had this crazy woman involved before you could deal with the crazy woman. So I think maybe that had something to do with how you were unnerved by it. But so I came in and I pitched kind of my take of Catwoman, which is pretty much the way exactly the way it came out of someone who's not a cat burglar and not a super sexy femme fatale, but someone who starts as kind of a disgruntled secretary and builds herself up into some kind of crazy mirror image of Batman. And like, you know, I made a point of saying she's kind of a homemade superhero, that like I even had that idea of the scene that's still in the movie of cross-cutting between Bruce Wayne in his super bat cave putting on his amazing outfit and then Catwoman's in her crappy car trying to find her Catwoman mask under some newspapers and a pizza box. Like, and Tim responded that right away. He had the idea for the Catwoman costume right away of something that's sewn and something that's homemade and something like that's, you know, built with like needles and thread that I think, and that, you know, that engages with each other right away. And, you know, so it's like, oh yeah, Batman, we got to work in Batman somewhere too. But I think our like, we definitely came alive over Catwoman. And without me even saying anything about Batman, he gave me the job. But it is funny talking about Batman though, and I'm, you know, sorry if I'm over answering your question, but I had a much more satirical element for Batman in my script of some, like the first, and again this is playing off my, you know, satirizing the first film almost, where the first image of my script for Batman Returns was the Batman logo, and you pull out and it's a store selling Batman merchandising that gets blown up. And you have I had all these great speeches of Batman making fun of his celebrity and, you know, kind of loathing his celebrity and all his fans and what have you. And, you know, Michael Keaton, who was great to work with, he was one of the best actors I've ever worked with in that he would go through my script and he would say, yeah, no, got to get rid of that. No, can't say that. Like, and he had a great point of like when Bruce Wayne puts on that suit, he can't have speeches. He can't do, you know, long. He's got to be very, you know, clipped and to the point, which, you know, and which when I saw The Dark Knight, you know, movies I love the Christopher Nolan movies, that like Christian Bale is in the Batman outfit. He's giving his long speech. He's got to like practically cough and reach over and get a bottle of water and like keep going. Like, you know, it's just really. It's like, okay, Michael Keaton, you are right.
keep it terse and simple.
When you're wearing that suit.
What did you think of, have you seen Batman vs. Superman?
I've seen them all.
What did you, since you like the Frank Miller graphic novels, what did you think of Batman vs. Superman?
Well, you know, I kind of missed it opening weekend, so I ended up seeing it in the middle of the week, and I'm like, and I was just a couple of people, and we like turned to each other like, why does everybody hate this movie? You know,
right?
You know, I actually, yeah. You know, I mean, it's Mike, you know, it sounds like I made you cry on the way home from Batman Returns. So, you know, I have a certain fondness of a movie that like, you know, makes people angry. Like, wait a minute, this is what I was sold. And like, I kind of like that about the movie. I mean, I thought, you know, and I thought Ben Affleck was a great Bruce Wayne and a great, like,
oh yeah,
you know, because I have a problem with the Bruce Waynes of even Michael Keaton, especially Christian Bale, where when they're Bruce Wayne, they're not horn dogs. They're not like, you know, real. I don't believe them. I believe them as superheroes more than I believe them as playboys, you know? So I thought it was great to see Ben Affleck in that part, but you know, I like the unpleasantness and the darkness and, you know, and Jesse Eisenberg blowing up his beautiful Asian assistant. That's the kind of like tang I like.
Yeah. Two things real quick. Yeah. I completely agree with you. I mean, for me, Michael Keaton's always going to be Batman, but I think that Ben Affleck was unbelievable as Batman. And I think he's been the best Bruce Wayne. on screen, that is.
Yeah, I totally bought him as Bruce Wayne, and he's a fine Batman. Yeah, I mean, I'm actually, you know, it's definitely where I come from. I'm not someone who worships Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies. I've never not had a great time in a Marvel movie, but they're not, you know, like what I live for. I like,
right.
You know, and you can certainly look over my career. I like movies where you're not being told how to act, that the effect is going to be different for every person. You can say that about every movie I've done, that people are going to react in an idiosyncratic way because, you know, I leave something for that third viewing. Hopefully you do see it three times. It gets better. Every movie I've ever worked on, the sound guy who has to watch the movie over and over, like, they'll come up to me and, like, after watching the movie like 40 times, I'm like, you know, I think I get it now. And I'm like, hey, this is my problem. The critics and all these people seeing Obi-Wan, they only see it one time. It's like, you see my movies 12 times, you're going to like them.
The other thing I wanted to tell you before we move on, I know Nick wants to jump in, is what scared me and what made me cry on the way home was when Catwoman kisses Shrek with the taser in her mouth. That's what really fucked me up when I was that was it. And the penguin was pretty rough.
Isn't it funny that's the kind of thing that infects your brain more than, like, and you can certainly say Christopher Nolan's movies are more openly dark.
Oh, yeah.
But since they're dealing in prose, not poetry, they don't get under your skin the way something like evocative like that will.
Exactly. Plus, I think we're more used to it now with our superhero, I guess with some of them, with the Batman movies being dark and the DC movies being dark, as to where then the only, what was the precursor? The original dark Batman movie, the light Donner Superman films, and then the 66 Batman show, which I love too, but.
Yeah, it's a hilarious, I mean, you know, you certainly weren't the only youth. We got a lot of flack, obviously, for, you know, Burger King ruining their Happy Meal, like, you know, as if that's what I'm being hired to do. I mean,
you couldn't sell like penguin with like black shit coming out of his mouth.
Yeah, the more people get unnerved by penguin eating a fish than people's heads being blown off and a whole city being massacred. Like, it's very bizarre.
Yeah.
Who? So was that your line in Batman Returns when he says, "Just the pussy I'm looking for"?
That was not my line, I'm afraid.
Okay.
You know,
I had to ask because it's one of the greatest lines in any movie ever.
Oh, like, yes, it's my line.
the way that Danny DeVito said it, like DeVito's performance in that movie is maniacal. It's amazing. You just he took the character and ran with it, and like, this is like before CGI made everything easy and lazy to a certain degree. Like, he's in that ridiculous suit and he's kicking so much ass in it, like being totally reprehensible. I just think it's such a great performance.
Yeah, no, he was also interesting to work with because I think the first draft, he said something I always remember, like, the first draft was, you know, very Danny DeVito. And he read the script and he said, you know, you wrote a Danny DeVito role. It's like, I don't want to play a Danny DeVito role. Like, you know, he says, pretend I'm not playing it and, you know, pretend it's Shakespeare and, like, really go for it. And then give me something to claw up to. You know, don't, you know, feed me what you think I want to hear. So, like, since he gave me permission, I pushed that role and he really did go for it. Like,
yeah, it's a crazy performance. I mean, it really is. Like everything you said, like from chomping on the fish to his death scene to everything about it. I mean, and again, it's such a, not that Burton's original wasn't dark, because it was. Like, this was a really twisted movie. Like, the beginning with Pee Wee Herman throwing Baby Penguin over the, you know, just to his death, presumably to his death, and like, just everything about it was just so unique. And I mean, like, that assault sequence in downtown Gotham towards like in the first act, it's still one of the best superhero fight sequences I've ever seen. It's amazing.
Shucks. Well, it's fun. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I had like, it was an interesting time. I mean, I definitely, Tim Burton and I, you know, started off great. And obviously we, you know, like dirt, we did have a falling out. And I think it's, you know, the way I explain it is, and if you look at the writers he's worked with since me, I think we're too much alike. You know, I joked it's like Rain Man with two Dustin Hoffmans. Like there can only be one crazy warp genius in the room at all. Not to call myself a warp genius, but you know what I mean? Like, you know, there can only be one freak in the room at one time. Like, you know, he likes to be the head freak. So I think he works with more stable people now.
Okay. I want to segue to one of my all-time favorite films ever that I've probably seen at least 50 times in my life.
Uh-oh.
And that is Demolition Man.
Oh, wow. All right.
Demolition Man, like, I came home today, I got Taco Bell, and I watched it. That's how much I love Demolition Man. I had all the toys when I was a little kid.
I need to see it again with Taco Bell, yeah.
it's just movies like that do not ever get made anymore, I feel.
Well, you know, it is, you know, I didn't realize that, you know, Joel and I had created, when we get together, we end up creating our own genre, our own, you know, I keep bringing up the Island of Misfit Toys where, you know, you have the squirt gun that shoots jelly. Now, it's a misfit toy, but to me, when I saw Rudolph Red-Nosed Reindeer, I was like, I want a squirt gun that shoots jelly. Like, if you like that kind of thing, you know, it's just, I think we both love movies, Joel Silver and I. And I think we've seen all the movies, so why would you want to see the same movie again? Why wouldn't, you know, we always assume everyone else has seen every movie. So if you're going to do a sci-fi action movie, you know, let's shake things up a little bit. You know, like, I can't help it. I didn't realize it was making it so humorous, but, you know, it's just natural.
How did you even conceive this?
Well, I mean, it was definitely a firm script in place by Peter Lenkoff, who wrote a very decent science fiction thriller. Like, you know, there may have been some attempted humor in it, but, not, you know, it's definitely not what the movie is now. And Peter Lenkoff will tell you that anytime you run into him. And Joel had been hectoring me like, hey, do this. And so, I mean, it's a weird story, but it was one of Johnny Carson's last Tonight shows. And you had to wait in line literally 20 hours. And so I waited in line 20 hours and I needed something to kind of do. So I said, okay, Joel, I'll do this. And so I ended up working out my take on Demolition Man mostly while standing in line waiting for one of Johnny Carson's last shows.
This is unreal.
But in that 20 hours, like it's definitely every futuristic, you know, because I mean, also with City Walk, it just opened in Universal City, which I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's like this kind of glossy.
Yeah. It's like Back to the Future Part 2 come to life.
Exactly. And like, I thought, what if, you know, Los Angeles, they decided to do that for the whole city? Because there was something about City Walk where it's way up on a hill and, like, no homeless people are going to crawl up City Walk. And I thought, what if we make the whole city like that? And from there, it took off. Like, you know, I let my imagination run wild. And, you know, the first draft of my script is too silly. It's almost like Woody Allen's Sleeper. And, oh, my God, I had, like, Stallone give these speeches and he finally, like, he just, I can't do it. Again, all my actors get speeches that they have to, like, okay, reality, give me a reality check on.
And how is there not a sequel proposed to that? I don't know if there was.
Oh, well, you know, okay, it's funny you say that. There was a whole element. Okay, I don't know how well you remember the movie. You probably remember the movie better than I do. But there was a whole element that still feels weird in the movie. Okay, there's a whole element of like his mother. He's looking for his mother, and mm-hmm. I think his daughter. His daughter, who's older than him.
Yes.
And everyone in the audience, all the test screens, they think, oh, it's Sandra Bullock's going to turn out to be his daughter. Just from some, even though that is, the logic doesn't work, we got that note all the time. But we had a whole scene with this actress who lives with Dennis Leary down below, and he runs into his older daughter, and they have like a conversation. But you know, the movie was running too long, so we cut it. So, Joel, movie comes out. The movie does better internationally than it does domestically, but he's still itching for somehow a sequel, and he's like, by the way, I have many stories of Meryl Streep being involved in the sequel. I have one for Heather's too, but this one, Joel goes, Meryl Streep's his mother. I mean, his daughter. And she's older than Stallone. And now she runs. She runs on the north side, on the west, the north side, the east side of the country. Runs like another utopia. And, you know, that's all we had, but.
Yeah, it seems almost just like in a way, because I'm personally done with reboots, remakes, sequels, like enough already. It seems almost like a minor miracle that there was never any sort of sequel, let alone a half-assed sequel or something dumb to Demolition Man or a recent reboot. It really, as Frank said, it really is amazing, and it really is a film that could only have come out at the time that it did. And what I think is so interesting is that you started with Heathers, which obviously was a critical success, and it became a calling card film for you and for Michael Lehman, the director, and it became a movie that so many people came to love because it really spoke to them. But it feels like I'm blown away that Joel Silver picked the Heathers guys to work with, because it feels just so amazing. Like you would have this small film come out and do what it did, and then all of a sudden Joel Silver is calling you. What was that like when you got in on his radar, and how did it all?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that I love the positive spin you're putting on this. Like I'm sure my agents would say, why did he ever meet Joel Silver? like Tarantino, stay in the video store, only write his own things. Like, the whole alternative reality career I could have had. Like, when you think about it, just from a Rotten Tomatoes Razzie standpoint, like, the jump from Heathers to Ford Fairlane could be the most historic drop for a screenwriter in history. But it's funny. I mean, the thing is, like, there is that alternate reality of, like, what if I just made small, quirky, independent films? And, you know, the thing is, I'm just not that guy. Like, I love every kind of movie. And so to me, Die Hard is up there with The Godfather and Badlands and Doctor Strangelove and all my favorite movies. It's a great movie. And Lethal Weapon's got a lot of problems, but I ended up watching it so much, and we were watching it at Christmas at my mother's house in Indiana, and Joel Silver calls me while we're watching Lethal Weapon and, talks about this project, Ford Fairlane. And so I took it as a sign. And, like, it's amazing. You know, Heathers was not a huge box office smash by any means, but it was, like you say, it was a calling card that it did affect a lot of people. And you'd think, and nobody, but it's funny when you write, and I always say this, a young person starting out, like, always write something crazy and original, because that's, and this is proof of it, that's who Hollywood wants to exploit. They don't want to exploit somebody trying to write a Marvel movie out of the gate. They want to take somebody with original voice and then have them do their superhero movie. But so I was getting a lot of offers for a lot of things, none of them were for dark, quirky, dark comedies that you'd think Heathers would, you know, inspire. But they were more like, can we do, you know, family films? Can we do whales being saved? And so, like, at least when Joel called, it was a movie I wanted to see. And so, and like, you know, Joel and I got a lot. I mean, we like I said, we could speak the language of movies. And, you know, I've always thought Joel was much more interesting than, like, Jerry Bruckheimer, who seemed to make corporate product outside of Con Air, which is its own. I always call that Jerry Bruckheimer's Joel Silver movie. Yeah, so I ended up in the and like I said, Joel loves movies. So he apparently set up a screening of Heathers before the movie came out. And after the first reel, he demanded the projectionist put it on again so he could watch the first reel over again. So he got me out of – I did not want to do Hudson Hawk, Mike, but he got Michael Lehman. So then I had the director of my first movie and the producer of my second movie ganging up on me. And, you know, so I ended up doing that. Probably – I've done three Joel Silver movies. Two would have been probably good.
Well, again, I mean, you know, Hudson Hawk, we could probably spend an entire pod. I mean, just from where Frank and I sit, not in the business, not in the industry, film fans, and looking at movies, honestly, from a certain remove and in a completely different fashion than a lot of people did. When I saw Hudson Hawk when I was a kid, I didn't know anything about budgets out of control and star vehicles and problems with this and that. I didn't know anything about that. When I watched that movie when I was younger, I just saw a fun movie. And throughout the years, I never understood why people were so pissed off about it. So I understand from your perspective, from, like, you know, actually creating this stuff that people are watching, you know, you have certainly a very different viewpoint on some people, but don't dismiss Hudson Hawk, because I could tell you right now, there's probably a lot of people out there who really enjoy that film.
They love it in Denmark. No, they love, you know, it's, you know, it's funny, like, for a quote unquote,
it took chances. It was different. And I think that people have a problem with different.
They do. They really do. Like, I mean, especially they're getting slightly better sometimes, but you know, Hudson Hawk was definitely a movie that didn't check in with the judge to say what kind of dive it was going to be doing. And people were angry. And, like, you know, you go back and the movie's got some issues. Let's put it politely. But, you know, you go back and look at it and it's just like, okay, the reviews are so, like, down in the dirt, like, logic, like, well, they wouldn't sing while robbing a vault. Like, that doesn't make sense. Like, yeah, I know it doesn't make sense. Like, what the hell? If that's where you're coming from, you're not going to have a good time.
Trust me. Frank and I have had this discussion so many times about critics ganging up on stuff, not understanding stuff, looking at things from the completely wrong point of view. And it happens so often. And again, I really feel that originality, certainly these days in Hollywood, from the big studio level, originality is very hard to come by. Like, it almost feels like it's a happy accident of sorts. I mean, like, it's just in 20 years, just thinking about the films that I grew up with in the 90s and stuff. I mean, the studio mentality couldn't be any more different.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the sad thing is, if you would talk to a studio person, they think they're perfecting something. They're perfecting, like, keeping everything by corporate committee and, like, making sure no originality sneaks in that they don't know about. They like a certain kind of originality, but one that's safe. And, like I like originality where maybe I don't know the actual final effect it's going to have when you mix everything together. That, you know, like I say, that's true originality, where it's not a calculated effect you're having. It is, you're doing a lot of different things, and you know, the alchemy is going to hit every, like I said, the alchemy is going to hit everyone a different way. And that scares people.
Hudson Hawk is a perfect example of a film as the reason why Nick and I started our podcast. Nick and I have quite the knack for loving films and appreciating films that were unfairly criticized or undervalued or, you know, underrated, underseen. That was the whole
intent. That's my wheelhouse.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was our whole intent.
I'm your poster boy.
Well, glad we finally got you on a year after we started our podcast. Fuck. Anyway, I didn't mean to kill the conversation.
No,
I do want to ask about Heathers because it's just it's obviously such an important film. I revisited it last night. I hadn't seen it in years, and I was shocked, to say the least. I remembered the broad strokes. I did not remember everything. I certainly did not remember large swaths of dialogue and some things. And that movie would never get made now. I mean, certainly it would never get made on a studio level. You'd have to make it independently. And
yeah, I mean, I would, you know, in many ways it wouldn't get made then either. It's like, it is what you say of like, this is not it. There was more chance for accidents back then when you had like the start of the video market and you had like these smaller companies like New World, like Vestron, like DEG that made Blue Velvet and Manhunter that you didn't have to clear customs as much as you do now. Now it's mm-hmm. like even the independent world, you have to like, you know, get a strip search for make sure that it's the right kind of originality. It's like, yeah, I mean, back then, you know, they didn't, you know, part of these smaller companies didn't, you know, as long as you got a reasonable poster that they could work with, you could get a lot of weird stuff in.
What was it like when Heathers, like, and I guess really more my bigger question is what, is Heathers the movie that you spent maybe the most time on set? Like, what film was it that you were involved in the most? Because I know that, you know, you hear stories about screenwriters. You know, I wrote my script. They bought my script. I was kept out of the process. I wrote my script. They loved me. I was brought on set for, you know, production rewrites, and no other writer was ever involved.
It is the great, you know, in many ways, it's the great tragedy of my life that Heathers is my first movie, because it was, you know, an experience that you don't get to have usually. And, you know, I got everything. I got to be on the set. I got to, you know, be involved in the production, but I got to like, you know, write something very original and also, you know, get credit for something original. Like back when I was writing, like, you know, it was bizarre. No one ever mentioned the writer, and everybody said, well, you know, Michael Aiden's going to get all the credit, but like the reviews, you know, it's bizarre that they always remember to mention me. Like sometimes now they mention me when they cut down the movie too. Like I think Kenneth Turan, when he reviewed Demolition Man for the LA Times, he said, Daniel Waters used to be a genius. Like, I don't blame the producer. I don't blame the director. I blame Daniel Waters. What happened? His crazy voice was brilliant in Heathers, but now it's making these action movies insufferable, like, you know, an arch and like, you know, just like, gee, Kenny. But it's great to be recognized as having a voice. But it goes back to my thing about Heathers, and Heathers was the first thing I've ever written, and this is another thing of teaching people how to write, is that like it was written from complete naivete, and I think naivete gets underrated and gives short shrift as like a powerful force, because sometimes naivete is the greatest force in the world. And like in that, like, I knew enough. If I knew now what I didn't know then, I probably wouldn't have written Heathers. Like I wouldn't have dared to write Heathers. Like, it's almost like you have to forget, you know, and I'm trying to go through this process again of re-naive myself when I write an original script, because it's like if you start to think about whether it's going to get made or how people are going to react to it, then you're killing yourself already. And Heathers was written from such a pure place, such a pure, okay, I'm opening up my newspaper, there's a movie I want to see, and nobody's making it, so I guess I got to write it. And if more people had that attitude, I think, you know, we would have more original movies, no matter, even though studios aren't making original movies, if you just come at it with more naivete, then maybe more would leak through. Because I think now everybody reads the trades, everybody gets online, and they self-censor themselves. Even before they start writing, they go, okay, well, I'm reading that this kind of horror film is really popular right now. And like when you read an article about what's popular right now, I always compare it to like seeing the light from a star that's a planet that blew up 100 million years ago. Like, you know, that you can't try to chase a trend, because once the trend gets printed somewhere, it's already dead. So it's like you have to really come at this place of like just like a baby, like a child, like an innocence of a child to make such – it's like you need the innocence of a child to make something so dark.
I definitely would want to also ask in regards to Heather's, was there anything in Heather's that – I mean, again, the way that – correct me if I'm wrong. This was an independent production through and through?
Yes. It wasn't independent in that, like, you know, we put it on each other's credit cards and we shot it in a backyard in a kiddie pool. Like, you know, it was like you had these, like they said, these companies like New World that were, you know, mini majors or whatever you want to call them, that they were companies that gave you a couple of dollars to make a movie.
But there was nobody essentially telling you no. You didn't have a no person saying, that's too dark, that's going over the edge, you can't do that,
not the way you would have when you're at a big major studio where it's like you hire 80 people to have that job, and like, so you have to get through each 80th person, like all through 80 people to get something done. But you did it, you know, like, I mean, famously, you know, the ending, you know, we got a good bill of health for Heather's, but there was, you know, the ending was a little more twisted and a little more expensive of, you know, Winona's character. She's the one who takes the bomb out of the school and kind of the whole school. There's a couple endings where she just blows herself up to save the school, and another ending where something happens and the whole school blows up and there's like a big prom in heaven. And, you know,
you didn't set out to write multiple. Like, how does this occur? A script is written, an ending is written, that's the ending that people read, the script gets greenlit because of that ending, presumably, or that part of the reason the green light comes is because of the way that it ends, and then somewhere along the way, there's three different endings. You know, this occurs because of someone...
I think, you know, it's a lot like Texas Hold'em, where you think you have a gold hand, but like, uh-oh, we're turning over another card now. Like, you know, that something, you know, yeah, a lot of it's changed my budget, but a lot of it is like, you know, I'm alone in my room in my underwear coming up with stuff and working things out. But then, you know, once it gets to somebody else, everybody's going to have some sort, like, you know, the director's going to have some influence and the producer's going to be like, wait a minute, I I've been up all night thinking about that thing you wrote. So it's not... You know, I can't expect it to be like, you know, me coming down off a throne and like undoing a scroll and saying, this is the script, you know, the Ten Commandments from Mount Sinai, that, you know, I do have to expect a little pushback. But, you know, yeah, and it's like a lot of that ending of, you know, the punch bowls full of the blue poison and all the dead characters are back to life, that a lot of it was just, it was a cost thing too. And yeah, I mean, I've gone back and forth on the ending. I think the ending is, I'm a big fan of the musical that they've done of Heather's that I hope more people get to see. And I know they wouldn't have done the musical, but didn't have the ending that the movie did have. So I've warmed to the ending. My brother reminded me of another ending that I wrote that I never really showed anybody that I think now is like, oh my God, this is the best ending. Nobody would complain about this ending, where at the end, Winona Ryder comes up to Martha and says, like, you know, do you want to pop some popcorn and watch some new releases? And Martha takes out a knife and stabs in the stomach and says, "Fuck you, Heather." And then she gets off her wheelchair and she can, like Dr. Strange says, "I can walk." And then Winona Ryder's with a knife in her stomach is lying on the ground saying, "My name's not Heather. My name's not Heather. My name's not Heather." To me, that's the greatest. That's the ending I should have done.
Oh.
Well, you'll certainly put some new thoughts into people's heads if they listen when they listen to this podcast or are fans of that movie for sure.
Yeah.
And Winona Ryder, I mean, all the people in the cast too. That's another thing too, is that every performance was just so spot on. And Winona Ryder, man, just, you know, Frank and I watched the trailer a little while ago before we were talking to you for this new show that she's on in Netflix.
They have a trailer for it? I haven't seen it.
Stranger Things. Yeah, it looks very cool. You know, and it's just like the world needs more Winona Ryder. And it's like, you know, she's so awesome. And like, you don't see her anywhere near enough. I remember when she showed up in Black Swan, it was like, just like terrific, like out of nowhere. She's awesome and crazy. Well, when you had a chance to reunite with her.
Oh, sorry. What? Yeah, I would just say generally about Winona, she's definitely got a special place in that. I always think she's the missing link between old Hollywood and new Hollywood, and that she's got this glamour to her. Like, you know, I call her Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard if it was directed by John Hughes. Or another thing I say is she's Audrey Hepburn that's been dropped off a coffee table. That there's something strange about her that I think is she's not typical old Hollywood, but she has a glamour unlike, you know, kind of a, you know,
she's mysterious.
Yeah, I mean, Lindsay Lohan's going to throw up in Audrey Hepburn's lap if she meets her. But, you know, Winona has a connection to old Hollywood.
And when you had a chance to make Sex and Death 101 with her, getting back, you know, with her, what was that like?
That was great. That was great because, you know, okay, both her character in Heather's, which is very well known, and her character in Sex and Death 101, which alas is less well known, but both could have been played a lot more evil, a lot darker. And what I like about Winona is she's got this darkness to her, but she creates this innate empathy. And I think she made both movies, but especially Heather's, like, you know, because my original drafts of Heather's were much more like Veronica was like almost a female Travis Bickle. And, you know, just putting Winona in the role, suddenly it changed the chemistry of the movie. And that, you know, you could see the forces fighting inside Veronica before, instead of her just being like a dark avenger for the evils of high school, that I think it just makes everything work, her personality.
What was it like collaborating with her brother?
Sorry, you got clicked there. I didn't hear the question.
Oh. I asked, what was it like collaborating with her brother?
Oh, more questions about Heather's? Okay. No, I mean, unfortunately, there was another person at the Thanksgiving table named Harvey Weinstein. So it kind of, like, I enjoyed going to London. I enjoyed working with my brother, developing the script and on the set. And we had an amazing lead actress who one day will be, despite us hobbling her career off the bat, I think she will be like a great star one day, Zoe Deutsch. But unfortunately, like, you know, and, you know, we had some, you know, problems with the movie that weren't Harvey related, and that, like, you know, that it was a kind of a, we were trying to adapt a book that maybe was very hard to adapt, a teen novel. And I tried to do my thing to it, and it only worked, I think, you know, before Harvey got involved, I think it worked a lot more. But unfortunately, you know, and unfortunately it spoiled me because, like, you know, we can talk about, you know, Ford Fairlane and Hudson Hawk not being successes and even Demolition Man. But, you know, hey, Hudson Hawk, baby, you know, it would have been Striking Distance or Mercury Rising without for me. Like, so, like, you know, if you hate the movie, you got to hate me. Like, you know, it's like I'm part of the reason it's one of the quote unquote, in quotations, worst movie ever made, because I'm the one who messed up the tone. I'm the one who came to the action movie dinner party and threw all the food on the ground. But unfortunately, Vampire Academy is my one film that really I can't take ownership of, because I really think, you know, it was messed up by foreign investors and Harvey pleasing foreign investors. They wanted an action movie. They wanted a pure action movie. And, you know, here's my line about Harvey Weinstein. I hope he's not listening to your podcast, but he's a rapist who keeps bragging how good he is in bed.
Hey, listen, man, I highly doubt that we'll probably have him on our show anytime soon. It goes without saying, he, the way that he meddles with movies is just beyond fucked up. Like, I can't even take it, and I don't even work in the industry.
Sometimes he makes movies better. I mean, he does have anecdote, like, he's got great Philomena stories. Like, sounds like Philomena was really in trouble until he took it. But I just know that he's not going to be talking about the way he quote unquote saved Vampire Academy to anybody else. So, you know, I think it's a chapter we both all sides rather not talking about.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
It has some good parts, but it just kills me to watch it. Can't watch it. Because, I mean, it made it, you know, and, you know, I can say that we had a test screening that these numbers may be meaningless to people, but, you know, we had a test screening that got an 80. His version got a 53, and he says, I don't care. I like my version better.
It's from buying movies with no intention to ever promote and give them an adequate release, to re-editing stuff, to taking things out of filmmakers' hands. Again, this is just from what people like us read outside of the industry and, you know, hear about. It's totally insane. But again, we can certainly move away from that. I just kind of want to jump around a little bit and go back to Ford Fairlane. Were you on set for any of that? Because we had a chance to speak to Rennie Harlan on our podcast, and Frank and I are both big fans of his work and his aesthetic, and especially those movies in the 90s, just where he was on fire. Were you on set at all seeing Ford Fairlane go down with Andrew Dice Clay and, like, all the craziness? Because that movie really is just completely fucking wild.
Yeah, I was on set quite a bit.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I mean, what I remember, there's a scene in a sorority with all these scantily clad girls. And I just remember showing up. It was like near UCLA where we filmed. I just remember showing up and standing in a hot kitchen, meeting John Hughes for the first time. I'm like, here, you know, we got these, you know, two teen movie writing perverts, like, you know, being caught, you know, being that the filming of a sorority scene. But it was kind of an awkward first meeting, because I know he's not a big fan of Heathers, but I did run into him later on, and he does like Hudson Hawk, but that's one of my memories from. Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it's nutty. I mean, I love, you know, Long Kiss Goodnight. I love what, you know, and seeing the movie again with a big audience. I was there with me and Andrew Dice Clay did a showing out here in Los Angeles last year. I think it was last year, maybe a year and a half ago, where Fairlane, it was like all people who got the movie. And it was a great screening. And you know, and part of it is it's such more than I can appreciate, just like such a bombastic Rennie Harlan film. And that it's just like, it's so not, you know, a Harold Faltenheimer movie, like, you know, like, it's just so huge. It's crazy. And like, and at times I used to mock that, but, you know, and in fact, my brother would tell you visiting the set of Ford Fairlane as a pre-med student was what made him want to be a director. Cause he said, okay, they are messing up my brother's dialogue so much. I've got to become a director. Like he'll tell you the scene. It was a scene between Priscilla Presley, Wayne Newton, and Dennis Quaid, where Priscilla Presley gets shot, and he's like, "Okay, what's going on here?" I mean, I kid Rennie. Rennie had, like, my first meeting with Rennie was like, you know, he definitely has his Scandinavian style, his Viking style comedy, where he would like, we have to have a scene where a guy's taking a car chase and the car goes through. I don't know why I'm making this. I guess Arnold and Rennie are my same impression, but the car goes through a house and the guy's taking a shit while reading a newspaper. The car goes through the house. He puts his newspaper down. The car goes through, and then he goes back to reading the newspaper. but I mean, like I said, again, that movie's got some issues in that it was like, okay, when I first was hired to do it, I went and saw Andrew Dice Clay at a small club, like, and I thought his comedy routine was a brilliant satirical takedown of masculinity and machismo. And I thought, this is going to be great. This Ford Fairlane is going to be like, typical male asshole, but like Inspector Clouseau-ized. And I think some of that still is in the movie. And Andrew Dice Clay kills me what a great comic actor he is. Like, I mean, I can't believe the little bits he does. But the problem is he started to become famous at the wrong time, and it was a wrong kind of fame. And suddenly, like, this character in quotations became like Donald Trump, actually, where suddenly he's being worshipped in Nazi rallies. And like, what the hell happened? And, and we were supposed to come out, like, it's funny, I can talk to my friend Suzanne Todd, who's one of the producers, about this. We were supposed to come out against Cadillac Man and Bird on a Wire, two films Nick Clement can't even defend. And we were having great advanced screenings. It was great. And then the decision was made, like, okay, wait, Dice's popularity is getting huger and huger. Let's wait 2 months and put it out in July. But those 2 months were like the most debilitating, like just death knell, anti-Andrew Dice Clay time. So instead of coming out against Bird and Wire and Cadillac, we came out in July and we were already dead. It was dead. And that movie was another movie that people came at from just a wrong point of view. Like, there's one line in the movie that says it all. And Morris Day has it. And it's a typical Dan Waters being too clever, but the line is, with friends like you, who needs enemas? and Siskel and Ebert, they go, there's a line in this movie that's, with friends like you, who needs enemies? Like, that's not, can you believe how unoriginal that line is? And I'm in a hotel room in New York. It's during the shooting of Hudson Hawk. This is how my life is. Yelling at the screen, it's enemas! It's enemas! This is not where the writer of Heathers wanted to be. But yeah, no, again, it was like just coming at it the wrong way. Because even those early screens, like, okay, this is movie's crazy. Like, you have to appreciate the movie's crazy. But, like, again, people, this is the bane of my existence. People who think I was attempting something I wasn't attempting and getting it wrong. Like, oh, he was trying to do a typical action movie and he blew it. Like, no, I'm not. At least, you know, say you hate it. Say it's the worst thing on it, but don't tell me what I was trying to do.
What about the seashells?
Yes, we need to end the show with the seashells.
It's funny. I was on jury duty recently, and like, you know, you can get out of jury duty if you say you're a screenwriter because they're afraid you're going to affect the verdict. And it's true, I have before. But I mentioned Demolition Man, and this, I just remember the female bailiff coming out, okay, with such a serious look on her face. You must tell me about the seashells. Like, really? Even you? The question is so much better than the answer. Because, you know, it's funny, my best friend, also a top screenwriter, to imply I'm a top screenwriter, but Larry Karaszewski is part of the writing team with Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, who wrote Ed Wood, People vs. Larry Flint, and the O.J. Simpson Show. He's my best friend, and we grew up together in Indiana. We both came out here at the same time, and I'm calling him up, and I'm like, oh God, give me some future stuff. I need stuff for just go in the bathroom. Like, okay, like what's instead of toilet paper? And he had this bag of seashells sitting next to the toilet, and I realized he is going to the bathroom while I'm talking to him. And he's like, I don't know, I got this bag of seashells here. And I just said, okay, got it. And so.
So, oh boy.
The thing is, you know, again, it's not the fun answer because I just wanted to, like, okay, I'm just going to say three seashells and let people all have their own theories.
Right.
But I don't really have a theory of my own. But then I run into somebody just the other night, I mean, less than a week ago, and he's like, well, you hold your ass open with one seashell and you clip the turd out with the two other seashells. So confident, like, of course, right? I mean, come on.
I put a lot of thought into it.
Just like, Jesus. Really? That's our future? What happened? Just like, but it was so serious. There was no mirth in his face whatsoever.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, here's a bathroom thing I want to do in Devilish, man. That was in one of the scripts. And, like, because I think about this every time I go to the bathroom where, whenever he does the seashells, Stallone comes out of a stall, washes his hands, and then he goes over, camera pans over, and it's the same shitty hand dryer that we have now. And he just, like, stands there for 10 minutes, like, what the fuck, still? 30 years in cryogenics, we haven't figured this shit out?
Unbelievable. And while we're on Demolition Man, I mean, the director of Demolition Man is just like Marco Brambilla. I'm assuming I say his name right.
Yeah, that's fine.
Talk about a guy who made one of the most unique action films, and then he just doesn't really do anything in film anymore. I know that he's got a different type of career, obviously, with the video installations and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, definitely Marco. I mean, you know, like I said, I have two hats. I have my, Dr. Jekyll, Heathers, yes, satire of teenagers today, like, you know, but I have my Mr. Hyde love crappy action movies side too. I think Marco was definitely in over his head where he definitely thought he was making Blade Runner. And like he spent so much time like on the art department, the way the layouts to the scenes and the way it was gonna look, and like, I just think he didn't have a great time. I don't think he had a great time the whole process of directing and dealing with actors and like over the shoulder close ups and mundane things like that, which I also have a problem. I have a problem with the mundaneness of filmmaking too. You know, when I'm writing a script, I'm a knight going out in the field every day. Like, I can do whatever I want, and like, I can wipe things away. I'm a master of my universe. I can take naps. Like, you know, the whole making your day element thing is just like, what? Wait, when's my nap? Like, you know, what's a lunch penalty? Like, you know, that I'm, you know, I do have problems with that. And I think Marco also would like to tinker with art installations more than, like, you know, try to get Stallone out of his trailer.
Didn't he come up through, like, Ridley Scott Associates?
Yeah. I mean, again, he's from the school of, like, you know, taking 3 hours to light a Coke can, you know. I don't think the grind of like a movie was his thing. And then whatever, like, you know, glimmers he had was beaten out of him on excess baggage. Like, yeah, I think he went to the mountain, grew like a 12-foot beard, and like, you know, came back. But
so he pulled an Al Gore.
Yes, exactly.
This poor guy.
Because I mean, even Elliot Goldenthal also, like, you know, I know you mentioned the score, you know. Yeah, he was another guy that thought he was making a much different movie. Like, I mean, he loved my script, but he still thought there was going to be a certain elegance to it that he, maybe now those guys, now when they just see how different, how unique it is compared to everything else that came after it, that they can appreciate it a little more. But they, I think they're both like, what the hell, we did a Stallone movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, I think time, the passage of time allows for new understandings and appreciations of things.
That's my motto. That's what I tell people when they're coming out of the theater. 10 years, you're going to love me.
Well,
thank you so much for coming on our show.
Well, I believe we haven't talked about the underrated Happy Gampers.
Oh, that's true. And considering the cast that you had involved with Happy Campers, I mean, again, I mean, I know that independent movies are so
first performance.
What did you say?
Jamie King's first performance was in that movie.
Yeah. It's a crazy, like, why is that movie not more well known?
Oh, Lord. I don't know. I have such that was such a grind that, I mean, like, that was my, you know, they didn't even let me hold the camera at a wedding. Like, you know, that this, to say that was my directorial debut is like, I mean, it was, you know, I never made a short film. I never made, it was a $12 million film school, which I'm sure New Line doesn't like to hear. But yeah, so it's like always going to be a bittersweet experience. I do remember doing sound for the movie. And Robert Altman was doing sound in The Next Stage Over. And I said, hey, Mr. Altman, I just tried to do MASH in a summer camp and I missed. Like, happens to the best of them. But, you know, yeah, so it's like, you know, again, that's, I need to go back and maybe I need to go back and watch that movie because, I mean, I do. That is another one when I type when I'm drunk on my bourbon and typing Daniel Waters underrated, it comes up a lot of times. So, like, I'm like, I directed that movie. Yeah. And it's sad because my nieces are going through summer camp now, and I just think it is such a feckin' world, like, so fraught with, like, somebody reboot Happy Campers. Come on. I got a much better script that the director messed up.
Well, honestly, man, I think it goes without saying we could probably chat you up all night, but you know, I really want to say thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about all these movies, these great movies that you've been a part of, and you know, obviously you've got two really big fans here.
Well, thank you. I can't win you guys over. I'm glad I got a demo of two.
Yeah, seriously, thank you so very much for coming on. I mean, your films are so ingrained in my life, as you know, and my love for cinema, that this was very special to be able to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you overcame your Batman Returns fears.
Yes, I did. I did.
It's a step in every man's childhood.
I wasn't able to get closure until I was able to speak with you about it. So
yeah, no, it's weird. I had weird Julie Newmar issues growing up too. She was like, she creeped me out too. I think it's, you know, something every guy's got to go to. Every generation's Catwoman's got to, like, unnerve people.
And yes.
Yeah, she Michelle Pfeiffer, really, man. She just that's still one of the best. Like I said it before in our chat, I mean, that movie is just such an amazing comic book movie, and she embodied that character so well. I mean, it's just amazing.
Yes, no, but, you know, we did write a Catwoman script. Never quite happened. Oh. Yeah.
So nothing to do with the Halle Berry Pitoff thing,
although when they did arbitrate that movie, they sent me like 90 scripts, just dumped them on my doorstep, and like it was a list of 36 names. I was the top name, and a good friend of mine, John Bricado, was the bottom name. And, you know, believe by the time they get, none of my script was involved. Yeah. I mean, definitely Tim wanted, you know, I wanted to do a Batman movie without Batman. So I was excited. He wanted to do kind of a more low budget Val Luton Cat People movie. And, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer just wanted to be in a movie, but, you know, we ended up just messing it all up. And now we got a Halle Berry movie.
Yeah, but no one remembers that, so Michelle Pfeiffer was on.
Yes, yes. Although Anne Hathaway's pretty good.
She's awesome, yeah, but, you know, she's the what?
But she's not going to give anybody nightmares.
Exactly. No, she's not.
She
doesn't kiss Christopher Walken with a taser.
She may give people nightmares for Les Miserables, but not for that one.
Hey, man, I like Les Mis.
Oh, I love Les. Actually, you know, I'm talking the wrong guys. Here I am making a Les Miserables joke, and I love Les Miserables. I think it's a brilliantly directed movie. See, I can't even make these jokes in front of you. All right, on that note, please cut the last part out. Any Les Mis chat?
Wait, what did you say?
Any Les Mis chat, cut it out.
Okay. Oh, so you're not going to come back on to talk about that movie with us, since we all three all love it.
Well, all right.
Fine.
You guys come from a great place, and so I won't tease you about Jade. All right.
I can freely admit to that one being a guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
I don't have any guilt while watching that movie.
Well, somebody just printed on a list of Brian De Palma's guilty pleasures. I'm like, guilty pleasures? These are pillars of my film going life. Like, you can't. These are guilty pleasures.
Wait a minute. Somebody tried to suggest that a certain section of De Palma's work was guilty pleasure, or
De Palma's. No, it was Brian De Palma himself talking about guilty pleasures, but they're all movies like Nightmare Alley and, like, you know, legitimately great movies to me.
Interesting.
Yeah,
big De Palma. We're big De Palma fans, and that documentary looks amazing.
Yeah, I'm seeing it tomorrow.
Oh.
Because, you know, movies open up right away in L.A.
That's true. Well, with a 6-month-old, even if I did still live in L.A., I wouldn't see anywhere near as much as I used to.
6 months, yeah, you get nothing.
Yeah. Well, you'll have to let us know what you think of De Palma. It's very high on our list to see. It looks fantastic. And again, thank you so very much for coming.
Keep me posted of when you cut this thing together and all that.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, guys.
Well, thank you very much again.
All right. We'll see you.
Thanks.